The scene, a typical courtroom. A jury of 12 looks on. The defendant, accused of a terrible crime, sits slumped in his chair, distraught. His lawyer, however, is oddly confident. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I will not stand here and try and defend my client by saying that he did not commit these crimes. Indeed, he did. The evidence is indisputable. But you should find my client not guilty because ultimately he is not responsible for his actions. You see, my client grew up in a struggling family in a rough neighborhood. He fell in with a bad crowd. He didn't get a proper education. He was exposed to crime at an early age. And why was his family in this situation? His great-grandparents came to that rough neighborhood as refugees from a devastating war. That war was triggered by a series of droughts, and the droughts were caused by an unusual change in ocean currents, which in turn was caused by a slight change in the sun's brightness over those years. Of course, we all know that the sun is powered by fusion reactions, and the rate of those fusion reactions is determined by the sun's mass. The sizes and types of stars that are born within the Milky Way galaxy is determined by its size and the number of mergers it goes through. And we can trace the origins of the Milky Way galaxy to a few hydrogen atoms existing within the first 15 minutes of the Big Bang. The laws of physics tell us how these hydrogen atoms began interacting with each other, eventually sowing the seeds of the Milky Way and its neighbors, leading to the formation of the sun, leading to the drought, leading to my client's unfortunate circumstances. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client is not at fault, because we can trace the origins of his circumstances and his actions all the way back to the beginning of the universe. Smiling, the lawyer sits back down, convinced that he has won the case. But as he looks across the bench to his opposition, he sees a broad smile on their face too. What are they planning? The prosecution stands to deliver their response. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the defense relies on a philosophical position known as causal determinism, a belief that everything has a cause and we can trace those causes with the laws of physics. But it is not quite that simple. The laws of physics as we currently understand them do not always allow us to confidently predict an outcome. Chaos theory scatters predictions for most systems. One can no more predict the weather a week from now, let alone the life story of a human being. As well as this, the fuzzy probabilities of quantum mechanics mean that nothing is truly certain. Perfectly predicting the behavior of atoms within the sun, for example, is simply impossible. And even putting those mysteries aside, the mysteries of consciousness and how the brain works muddies the water even further. Your Honor, we cannot predict anything. Free will survives. The defendant had a choice. The prosecution sits, and the judge is left open-mouthed and baffled. It seems not only is the defendant on trial, but the nature of free will itself. Who is right? Imagine, for a moment, a superintelligent being. Far wiser and more capable than any human, so vastly removed from our own abilities that we can scarcely comprehend it. This being isn't just intelligent, but also observant. It can see and record the current position and velocity of every single atom in the entire universe. A water molecule floating in the Andromeda Galaxy, a silicon atom buried thousands of miles under the ground, a sodium ion pushing to and fro in your cerebral cortex. Nothing can escape this being's notice and attention. It has perfect knowledge of the state of every single thing. And this superintelligent being is also armed with another tool, a complete knowledge of physics. Gravity, electricity, magnetism, heat, and more are all at its disposal. This being has, in a sense, a perfect understanding of the way nature works. The being can therefore put its knowledge of these laws into practice. Knowing the state of every particle in the universe equips the being with the ability to tell the future. By applying the laws of physics to the motion and behavior of every atom, the being will know exactly, with ultimate precision, where those atoms will go, what they'll do next, and how they'll act. And the being can repeat this again and again, advancing forward in time, allowing it to predict with utter certainty the entirety of the future of the universe. This being can see the chain of cause and effect stretching through the eons. It will see the future laid out before it from the microscopic to the cosmic. It will see stars grow old and die. It will see galaxies merge. It will see new planets form and life arise. It will see the causes behind the emergence of intelligent creatures. Creatures who believe that they are acting of their own free will, able to make choices as they please. But the being will see that these creatures are fooling themselves. Every future act, every choice, every decision, every effect can be clearly seen by the superintelligent being, as clearly as we can see the past. Known as Laplace's demon after its originator Pierre-Simon Laplace, this thought experiment is the ultimate expression of a philosophical concept known as causal determinism. In this view, which had gathered momentum in the years leading up to Laplace's publication in 1771, every effect to occur throughout the cosmos is preceded by a cause, which in turn are preceded by their own causes, all following the laws of nature in an unbroken chain going back to the beginning of the universe. In other words, every single future act and movement from all entities in the universe is already determined, already decided before it happens. The past and present state of the universe dictates, through the laws of nature, what the future will be like. It's just causes and effects going on forever. There is no way to escape it, no way to change it. The future is already set in stone. Laplace wasn't the first scientist to put forward the notion of causal determinism, especially in such blunt terms. Indeed, Laplace's own thoughts were inspired by the work of earlier scientists, most especially Isaac Newton. Though Newton himself wasn't a determinist, he believed that divine, supernatural intervention played a part. But it wasn't Newton's theological insights that led to Laplace's demon. It was his physics. Newton laid the groundwork for our modern conception of physics by bringing together two strands of thought. The first strand was introduced by Galileo, the idea that mathematics could be applied to explain and predict natural phenomena. Of course, astronomers for millennia throughout human history have used mathematical tools to predict the motions of heavenly bodies, but Galileo was the first to broaden these tools to explain phenomena everywhere, not just in the heavens. And the second strand that led to Newton's revolution was the concept of space itself. In his work, space took on a new meaning. It wasn't just an abstract mathematical construct, but a separate entity in the cosmos. It was an empty stage on which the actors could act their parts. Newton applied Galileo's mathematics to the concept of space to arrive, eventually, to his laws of motion, which were a triumph in understanding our natural world. With Newton, you could record an object's position and momentum and predict where that object would go from now until eternity. And this mechanical, clockwork view of motion and interaction sowed the seeds that would eventually become causal determinism. Laplace, who was a master of mathematics and scientific genius in his own right, spent much of his life extending and perfecting Newton's work. And while he kept his faith closely held to his chest, historians believe that he was at best agnostic. To him, causal determinism was obvious. Today, causal determinism forms the philosophical bedrock of all of physics and any science derived from physics. Physics assumes that the universe is deterministic and that every current state, every effect, has a cause. Supernatural intervention and events that occur without precedent are regarded as unphysical and therefore literally unreal. In modern physics, it's not that such extraordinary events shouldn't happen, it's that they literally can't happen. This causality of the universe empowers physicists to make predictions based on the current configuration of a system, and it allows physicists to discover laws of nature. Because if the universe wasn't causal, what would be the point of natural laws? Because anything could happen for no reason at all. In essence, physics is the scientific expression of the very philosophical concept of causal determinism. And it works. It works very, very well. Perhaps the earliest example of the power of causal determinism was in the prediction of total solar eclipses. Ancient societies had tried and failed to predict eclipses with any sort of reliability. It wasn't until Newton's insights that we were able to make perfect calculations. And in the early 1700s, the astronomer Edmund Halley predicted, to the minute, a total solar eclipse that passed over London, and the style of maps he designed are still in use today. Indeed, today you can open up any planetarium software and be presented with a map of the stars above your head right now. You can change the date to anything you wish, a week from now, 1,000 years from now, and be told with uncanny precision what the new sky will be. You can list out total solar eclipses going forward as far into the future as you wish. And it is all powered by determinism. The planets of the solar system have a current state, a current position, and a current speed, and their future motion is ruled by the force of gravity. So you can take our mathematical description of gravity and apply it to the current state of the solar system, predicting the future movements of the planets. But physicists haven't stopped there. They've developed intricate, complex theories to explain the forces of nature. They've learned how to combine these theories to describe complex phenomena, from predicting how long our sun will shine to when the Milky Way will merge with Andromeda. They have brought order to the universe, realizing that the cosmos isn't governed by capricious gods or supernatural creatures. It is all just particles interacting with each other, governed by a finite, understandable set of natural laws that we can describe with mathematics. Of course, our knowledge of physics is not yet complete. If you rely purely on Newton's formulation of gravity, for example, eventually your predictions of the future movement of the planets would be incorrect. So you would have to switch to Einstein's updated formulation of gravity to make more accurate predictions. And that's not an isolated example. There are many holes and gaps in our modern formulation of physics. From dark matter to superconductors, we do not have a perfect knowledge of physics, nor do we have perfect knowledge of the current state of every particle in the universe. Indeed, even with all of our knowledge of physics combined, we cannot say with any certainty what fate will befall every single planet billions of years from now. There are just too many particles to keep track of, with too many individual interactions, for us to make a perfectly accurate prediction. And the solar system, as complex as it is, has nothing on an object like the human brain. We could map every single atom inside every single neuron and still not be able to predict the behavior of those atoms a microsecond into the future. However, while there is still much to learn, that does not put a dent in the fundamental idea behind determinism. We do not have the capabilities of Laplace's superintelligent being. We do not have perfect knowledge of the state of the universe and the physical laws governing its behavior. But that is an expression of our own human limitations, not a fundamental limit in determinism. The cosmos still ticks along, with one set of causes inescapably leading to another, according to the laws of physics. It is just that we can only keep track of a limited number of interactions. And so, if causal determinism is true, then free will is an illusion, at least in principle. This bedrock of modern physics is a hammer blow to our control over the future. This is because everything that ever happens is preceded by a set of causes that follow the laws of physics, not just total solar eclipses. If you ever find yourself running late for work, you can follow the chain of causes back into the past to discover why. You had to change your shirt because you spilled your coffee. You spilled your coffee because you bumped the chair. You bumped the chair because you moved it last night to grab something from the top cupboard. And on, and on, and on. And it's not just the macroscopic. Causal determinism says that every choice we make is ultimately due to the movements of particles within our neurons, which are again all governed by the laws of physics. There are no surprises, no decisions, no effect without a cause, just components of the universe obeying the laws that govern them, and nothing more. We may never develop the sophistication to predict with any degree of accuracy what a person may decide to do at any given moment, but that doesn't mean that their choices aren't already predetermined. Deep down, we are just a set of atoms interacting with each other according to natural laws, following a chain of cause and effect stretching back billions of years to the Big Bang itself. In a causally deterministic universe, every choice we make in our entire lives was already decided for us, eons ago, before we or anybody else existed. And so, this sounds fairly conclusive. A clockwork universe in which we are just a cog. But Laplace's superintelligent demon had a flaw. It didn't, couldn't know everything, because in 1771, Laplace himself did not know everything. Drip, drip, drip. The leaky tap has been keeping you up at night for a week. You haven't been able to sleep. You haven't been able to tune it out. You haven't been able to ignore it. It just keeps dripping. The problem is that a dripping tap is a perfect example of what's known as a chaotic system. Chaotic systems come close to having regular patterns, but they never quite repeat. If the dripping tap was regular, with each drip coming at the same interval, your brain would quickly filter it out, and you could ignore it and return to sleep. Whereas if the drips were truly random, your brain could also filter it out as just another source of noise. But it's neither. It's chaotic. It's almost regular, but not quite. Almost random, but not quite. It's something in between. Your brain is never able to predict when the next drip will arrive. And so, it keeps you awake. And our modern understanding of chaotic systems traces back to 1961. All Edward Lorenz wanted to do was figure out why his computer program wasn't working. A researcher at MIT, several years before, Lorenz had become interested in the problem of predicting the weather. Weather, like any other physical system, was deterministic. If you knew various properties, like wind speed, temperature, and humidity, you could apply the laws of physics to predict how the weather would change. But this was no easy calculation. Even the simplest models required keeping track of 12 separate variables, all tangled together through complex non-linear equations, which Lorenz could not solve by hand. He had to use a computer and its efficient number-crunching capabilities. After running one forecasting simulation, Lorenz wanted to see the simulation play out again. To save time, he started the simulation from the middle, using a printout of the midway results as the input for a new run. But to his surprise, he got a completely different answer. It would take Lorenz years to uncover the fundamental problem and wrap his head around what was going on. And in the process, he accidentally became the founder of modern chaos theory. The issue was the way that the computer stored and printed the values of the variables in the simulation. Computers only have a finite amount of memory, and so they stop keeping track of precision after a certain number of digits past the decimal. In Lorenz's case, his computer kept track of 6 digits of precision. But to make the printout more readable, the simulation only printed up to 3 digits. Lorenz, knowing mathematics, assumed that the extra 3 digits of precision wouldn't matter. These were just tiny rounding errors, less than 1 part in 1,000, and so they shouldn't have affected the overall output of the simulation. In the general understanding at the time, small errors simply stayed small. But those seemingly insignificant differences between the numbers stored on the computer and the ones printed out led to drastic changes in the output of Lorenz's simulation, making completely different forecasts of the weather. What was going on? Was determinism dead? Did our mathematical understanding of physics, laid down by Newton centuries ago, fail with this seemingly simple task of weather prediction? The answer was yes and no. Chaos theory is complicated. Before Lorenz, our understanding of mathematical physics relied on a few very basic assumptions. One assumption was that if you wanted to predict the behavior of a system you were studying, you needed to know both its initial conditions and the laws of physics governing that system. This is causal determinism. To make better predictions, you just needed two things: more accurate measurements of the initial conditions and better laws of physics. But crucially, it was thought that while your understanding of the future of a system would always get better the more you knew about it, there would be a point of diminishing returns. If you measured the initial conditions to a certain level of accuracy, then you should get a corresponding level of accuracy in your final prediction. So if you make a small improvement on your initial measurement, then you should also see a small improvement in your final prediction. The small stuff just stayed small. But apparently, this was not the case for the weather. The weather was extremely sensitive to initial conditions. Lorenz discovered that the tiniest of changes to the initial conditions would completely blow up the entire system, sending the weather on a totally different track. It was chaotic. In 1972, meteorologist Philip Merrilees organized a conference where Lorenz presented his findings. Merrilees himself suggested the title of the talk, a phrase that still echoes today, decades later. Predictability: does the flap of a butterfly wing in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? This question lies at the heart of what we now call chaos theory. Not every physical system is chaotic, but many are. To qualify as chaotic, a system must have two very important properties. Number one, the equations describing the system must be non-linear, meaning that the variables don't follow a straight line. And number two, the system must be sensitive to initial conditions, where small changes in the beginning don't die out, but rather amplify themselves as the system evolves. This combination leads to chaos, meaning that tiny changes, even ones that physicists would normally consider insignificant and irrelevant, can lead to dramatically large effects. This can make it all but impossible to proceed with accurate predictions of a system's behavior. While modern chaos theory found its beginnings with Lorenz studying weather systems, physicists had been encountering it for centuries without fully realizing it. When Isaac Newton published his universal theory of gravity in the late 1600s, he was able to apply his newfound mechanical theory to a slew of unsolved problems in the solar system, like the speed of the moon's orbit and the regular raising of the tides. But his theory had limitations. It worked perfectly when only two objects were involved, but struggled to handle three. Known as the three-body problem, it was a thorn in the side of Newtonian mechanics for centuries. Genius after genius, Laplace included, would throw themselves at the problem, striving to find a simple, succinct solution to describe the mutual gravity among three massive objects and predict their future behavior. In 1887, to celebrate his 60th birthday, Oscar II, King of Sweden, even announced a public competition to find a solution to the three-body problem. Nobody could find such a solution, but the judges eventually awarded the prize to one Henri Poincaré, a French mathematician who ended up writing, and revising multiple times, an entire book exploring the subject. In his explorations, Poincaré discovered that there were certain orbits that never repeated themselves, but yet didn't collapse. This was strange. Conventional thinking of determinism dictated that planetary orbits were either stable or unstable. Either a planet looped around in the exact same orbit year after year without variation, or the gravitational stresses pulling on the planet would send it crashing into the sun or flying out of the solar system altogether. But Poincaré found something new. The orbits of the planets were stable, in a sense, meaning that they didn't go wandering off, but they never quite repeated themselves, making future prediction of their precise paths the entire point of causal determinism impossible. This was the beginning of chaos theory, though Poincaré didn't realize it, and nearly a century later, Edward Lorenz would find similar behavior in his studies of complex weather patterns. He found that while the state of his simulated weather system never exactly repeated itself, once the system attained a certain combination of temperature, wind speed, etc., that precise combination would never appear again, there were still larger patterns to the behavior of the weather system. The temperature would regularly fluctuate between cooler and hotter, the winds would blow in one direction, diminish, then shift, and so on. But it was never exactly the same. The weather system would find itself cycling, but it was never exactly the same. It seemed to Lorenz that predicting the weather was just as impossible as predicting the gravitational motion of three objects. Another example of a chaotic system is animal populations. You might assume that once you understand predator-prey relationships and the life cycle of a species, it would be easy to predict the future population. But the equations governing population growth, known as logistic maps, can be chaotic. The population may cycle through semi-regular patterns, but they'll never quite repeat. And knowing the population one year does not guarantee that you'll know the population the next. Of course, not all systems are chaotic. A pendulum, for example, as long as it's not affected from the outside, will not follow this chaotic trend. But many are, and chaotic systems are annoyingly sensitive to initial conditions. The tiniest change at the start, no matter how small, can quickly amplify. Through sheer brute force of advanced computation, meteorologists are able to provide reasonably accurate weather predictions going out a few days. But beyond that, the chaotic nature of the Earth's weather system prevents forecasting further. And this chaos is built into the fundamental nature of the systems. Even Laplace's demon would struggle here, because it would have to be truly supernatural, having infinitely precise information on the current state of the universe. Anything less, any finite amount of knowledge, and chaos would eventually reign, taking the system in unpredictable directions and ruining the dream of determinism. But chaotic systems are still physical systems, which means they are causally deterministic. Every single step in the evolution of a chaotic system is directly caused by the previous state of the system, and the evolution of that system is still governed by physical laws. Chaos theory, therefore, does not destroy the fundamental principles of determinism, but it does make it difficult, if not outright impossible, to accurately predict with perfect precision the future evolution of the universe. And yet still, despite this, chaos theory does not rescue free will. We may never, in practice, be able to predict the choices and behaviors of human minds, but that doesn't mean that our future decisions aren't already decided by physical laws. It just means that we may never be able to apply determinism to humans. We will always remain mysterious and seemingly unpredictable, but deeper down, as deterministic as we always have been. Chaos theory is a classical theory of physics, rooted in the same clockwork mechanics as Newton's gravity. With enough precision, you can at least make a reasonable guess as to the next step that a system will take. It takes time for chaos to unfold. But there is another branch of physics that shakes these very foundations. A branch of physics where future events cannot be predicted with any certainty at all. Where determinism, the very bedrock of modern physics, completely falls apart. It is quantum mechanics, the physical theory that describes the subatomic foundations of our world. And it might just hold the keys to unlocking free will. Erwin Schrödinger was sick of it. He had watched in horror as quantum mechanics, a field he had played a key role in creating, had evolved in a direction he found repulsive. Eventually, he declared, "I don't like it, and I'm sorry that I ever had anything to do with it," and left the quantum world behind. But before he departed quantum theory for good, he left behind one last parting gift for the rest of the scientific community. It was a thought experiment, now famous and repeated every time quantum mechanics is mentioned, involving a rather unlucky cat. The thought experiment is simple. You put a cat in a box. You construct a device that has a 50-50 chance of killing the cat. You wait for the device's timer to go off. You open the box and find the cat either dead or alive. Pretty straightforward, except for what quantum mechanics says about the state of the cat prior to opening the box. According to the most popular interpretation, the cat exists in a state of both alive and dead simultaneously, and it's impossible, literally impossible, no matter how ingenious or precise you are, to determine the cat's fate until you open the box. Once you do, out comes one of the two possible states, and the rest of physics proceeds normally. But why a cat? Schrödinger had deliberately chosen a familiar, cute experimental subject to point out what he thought was a glaring absurdity in quantum mechanics. The complete lack of determinism. Only probabilities worked in quantum calculations. You could never be certain about what was going to happen. But once you performed a measurement, in this case, opened the box to check on the fate of the cat, all the probabilities and indeterminism simply vanished, to be replaced with the normal and deterministic laws of physics. To Schrödinger, it seemed ridiculous. Experiments in quantum mechanics do appear to be totally random, but that apparent randomness mostly happens at atomic or subatomic scales, well out of the realm of normal human perception. In 1921, physicist Otto Stern conceived of a straightforward experiment to bring the quantum world into direct view, and a year later, Walter Gerlach would construct it. Now today, as the Stern-Gerlach experiment, you start with a source of particles, usually electrons. You send those electrons through a region with an inhomogeneous magnetic field. The field is slightly stronger in one direction than the other. Electrons have a very specific response to magnetic fields, but this response can come in one of two directions, up or down. If you send beams of electrons through the device, then half of the electrons will get deflected upwards and the other half downwards. But here was the issue Stern and Gerlach found. It was simply impossible to predict what an individual electron would do. You can calculate a probability over a large number of electrons, half will go up, half will go down, but the most you can say about any one particular electron is that it has a 50-50 chance. And that was just the beginning. If you perform the experiment along one axis, after the process of measurement, all the electrons will be happily spinning in the same direction. But if you then attempt to measure their spin along a different axis, quantum randomness rears its head again, and you're forced into another world of probabilities. The lesson here is that measurements of one quantum property do not guarantee certainty for any other quantum properties. No matter what, you're going to encounter uncertainties. Multiple experiments like the Stern-Gerlach setup demonstrated that the subatomic world played by different rules. Rules where the determinism that had ruled physics for centuries did not apply. A few years later, in 1926, Schrödinger would attempt to sort out the messiness of the quantum world by introducing his now famous wave equation. In this approach, every particle in the universe had a wave associated with it. These waves behaved like any other familiar wave would, like water waves and electromagnetic waves. They could add together or cancel each other out, they could spread from a small point to cover a large area, and so on. Schrödinger hoped that his wave approach would do away with all the indeterministic nonsense. He believed that the results of quantum experiments only appeared to be random because we weren't including all the physical aspects of subatomic systems. We were missing the waves associated with all matter, and so that limited our ability to understand subatomic systems and predict their future behavior. Indeed, Schrödinger thought that these waves associated with matter particles were real entities, as physical as anything else. But other quantum pioneers, like Werner Heisenberg and Max Born, disagreed. While they celebrated Schrödinger's work and the monumental advance in understanding quantum systems that it was, they took a different interpretation. They viewed the waves as unreal and unphysical. Contrary to Schrödinger's hope, they interpreted the waves as mere expressions of the fundamental uncertainty that Schrödinger was trying to do away with in the first place. In this view, now known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, every particle in the universe still has a wave associated with it. This wave propagates, evolves, and interacts with other waves the same way any other physical wave does. But the wave doesn't manifest itself in direct observation. Instead, the wave represents a mapping of the probabilities of the future fate of the particle. Where the wave is strong, we are likely to find a particle in that location the next time we go looking for it. Whereas where the wave is weak, we may still find the particle there, but our chances are low. Schrödinger's wave equation allows us to make predictions in quantum mechanics, but these are predictions of probabilities and likelihoods, not hard facts. And so, bizarrely, quantum mechanics is both deterministic and indeterministic at the same time. The probability waves start from initial conditions and evolve according to the known laws of physics, namely the Schrödinger equation. Indeed, if you know the initial conditions of a quantum system, you can predict precisely what the wave equation will do. But, crucially, you don't know how the particle itself will behave. That future is subject to the probabilities associated with the wave equation. You can make guesses and assign chances, but that's as good as you're ever going to get. And yet once you make a measurement, the wave function vanishes, the particle appears, and you can follow standard classical physics to track its progress and predict its future behavior. And so it seemed that in quantum mechanics there was a fundamental limit to our knowledge of subatomic systems. And the ultimate expression of this limit came in the form of Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. For some pairs of quantities, you could never precisely measure both simultaneously. The most common example is position and momentum. You can know a little about both of these quantities for a given particle, or a lot about one of them, but you can't know a lot about both of them. The more you learn about position, the less you know about momentum, and vice versa. For Schrödinger, this perversion of his wave mechanics was a step too far, and he wasn't alone. In fact, he got the idea for the cat-in-the-box experiment from his friend and colleague Albert Einstein, who also held deep reservations about the direction quantum theory was going. Einstein believed that the Copenhagen interpretation was following the wrong track. Instead of baking in uncertainty into the theory of quantum mechanics, he thought we should instead view these threats to determinism as a sign that our theories were incorrect, and that we should seek a deeper, more fundamental theory that rescues a deterministic vision of the cosmos. Schrödinger would eventually head to other pursuits, and Einstein would go to his grave without ever finding such a theory. Indeed, nobody has found a deeper theory sitting behind quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics has survived every experiment thrown at it, leading to a physical understanding of the microscopic world that powers everything, from semiconductors to modern medicine. But there have been attempts to recover determinism within the framework of quantum mechanics, such as the idea of superdeterminism. In this interpretation, the results of quantum experiments only appear to be random because we aren't looking at the whole picture. Ultimately, every system is a quantum system, not just the subatomic particles in the experimental apparatus, but the apparatus itself, and the building it's housed in, and the entire universe. According to superdeterminism, if we were to keep track of every single particle from the beginning of our universe onwards, then the randomness of quantum experiments would disappear, and we would be able to make perfect predictions even about subatomic systems. Other attempts, like the many worlds interpretation, replace the indeterminacy of quantum mechanics with a branching parallel reality every time a quantum interaction happens. In this interpretation, everything is deterministic and perfectly predictable because there is a reality available for every possible outcome. And so, it remains an open question as to whether quantum mechanics is fundamentally deterministic or indeterministic. If a deterministic interpretation prevails, or if we one day discover a deeper, hidden theory, then that will place the subatomic realm on the same deterministic footing as the rest of science, with the same implications as to the nature of free will. But even if subatomic systems truly are indeterministic, it still doesn't guarantee free will. We can still predict the motion and behavior of subatomic particles, we just have to replace hard certainties with fuzzy probabilities. We can't say for certain what a given particle will do, but we can provide solid guesses. And indeed, it's not even clear how quantum indeterminism could lead to free will. Quantum mechanics dictates the behavior of subatomic particles, while the brain is a much larger, much more complex system. Chaos theory and quantum mechanics both shook the foundations of our classical understanding of physics. The world we live in turned out to be much more complex, rich and varied than the clockwork mechanics of Newton and Laplace led us to believe. But the core philosophical principle behind science, that of causal determinism, remains. All events have causes, and those causes are determined by the laws of physics. Yet even though causal determinism forms the bedrock of modern physics, there is no firm link between physics and the concept of free will. Perhaps, despite all our advances in understanding the causal structure of the universe and the natural laws that govern it, we and our brains may not be bound by fate after all. The experiment is simple. You take a participant who has received damage to some part of their visual cortex, the part of the brain tasked with processing visual information. The damage could be from a stroke, a lesion, or anything. The cause doesn't matter, as it just affects how the experiment is set up. You then show the participant cards with images printed on them and ask them to identify the image. Against all expectations, blind participants are able to guess the nature of the image, with chances well above random. In another experiment, you toss a ball at the blind participant, and they will have the uncanny ability to catch the ball far more often than they should. By all accounts, it seems blind people have some sort of visual perception, despite their inability to see. That said, the participants never express any degree of certainty about their abilities, nor can they explain how they can catch the ball or why they know the correct image. The best they can describe the experience is as an intuitive gut reaction, a feeling about what the image is or where the ball is going to fly, but not the certainty of conscious knowledge. There is no definitive explanation for this phenomenon, known as blind sight, but it obviously has something to do with the staggering complexity of the brain and the fact that it operates on multiple levels that we barely understand, most of which are hidden from us. While it's difficult to put estimates on the information processing capabilities of the brain, because the brain is not a computer and does not churn through information like one, a rough estimate is that less than 0.05% of the information arriving into the brain from our senses makes its way into our consciousness. In fact, our consciousness represents only a small fraction of the full capabilities of our brains, which are so complex it almost defies description, let alone understanding. At a cellular level, a typical human brain will have around 86 billion individual neurons. The neurons connect to each other to form a network with over 100 trillion connections. And besides the brain itself, we also have a complete nervous system, which constantly shuttles electrical signals to and from the brain. Plus, there is the endocrine system, which is another way that the brain and body interact with each other. And that's just the base cellular level. Neurons from different regions of the brain work together in multifaceted, intricate ways to perform even simple tasks. Put simply, the brain is one of the most complex structures known to humanity. This means that despite all the advances we've made in physics, chemistry, biology, neuroscience, and philosophy, we still do not have a complete, or some might argue, even rudimentary understanding of how the brain works and how we arrive at our conscious experience of the world. And of course, our consciousness is the key to free will, as it's through our own self-awareness that we develop the belief that we are in charge of our own decisions, and that while we are influenced by the past, the chain of events leading up to our decisions does not determine what those decisions are. When it comes to deciding if we have free will or not, we have to contend with two basic observations. The first is that causal determinism has been found to be incredibly useful in explaining the workings of the natural world through the physical sciences. Even with chaos theory and quantum mechanics, physicists still use a deterministic philosophy to approach their inquiries into nature, and that philosophy has yielded amazing insights. But we must also acknowledge the astounding complexity of the brain and the mysterious origins of our own consciousness, with its sense, illusion or not, of free will. If we are to take causal determinism to its logical extreme, then in principle, we could track every single connection, every single neuron, every single proton, molecule, atom, and every single subatomic particle in the brain, and use our knowledge of fundamental physics to predict what those particles will do. And from there, predict how the brain will respond and evolve in time, what our conscious experience of that evolution will be like, and ultimately, what decisions we are going to make, regardless of whether we felt like we had free will or not. If chaos theory is important in these calculations, then we would not be able to make predictions about the brain's decisions very far into the future, but we could still do it in the near term. And if quantum mechanics is important in these calculations, then we would have to replace precise predictions with fuzzier probabilities, but we could still provide solid guesses. And so in a deterministic universe, free will is only an illusion, a byproduct of some deep neurology that gives rise to consciousness, and our brains are going to do what they were always going to do, as they are bound by the conditions of the universe in the past and the laws of physics. But because the brain is so complex, beyond our current understanding, we simply cannot predict human behavior. We can only hypothesize about the possibility of it. Without firm evidence that free will in the brain is an illusion, we have to trust that our clockwork mechanistic understanding of physics extends from basic subatomic interactions all the way up to the level of consciousness and free will. The nature of our own consciousness is one of the largest unsolved mysteries in modern science. Ultimately, we do not fully know how we are self-aware. Known as the hard problem of consciousness, the fundamental issue is that we do not know how to explain how it feels to be self-aware. As philosopher Thomas Nagel phrased it, we don't know how to describe what it feels like to be us. You have your own personal experience of being you, a feeling of selfhood distinct from any other feeling, and any attempt to explain consciousness from a deterministic perspective must grapple with that experience. One popular theory of consciousness is that basic perceptions like sight and taste re-represent themselves in the prefrontal cortex, giving us a sensation of experiencing those perceptions. In another theory, thoughts and emotions constantly battle for attention in our brains. When one is in the spotlight, so to speak, we experience that thought or emotion. Whereas other perspectives on consciousness view it as the complete opposite, an integrated network of experiences, emotions, and thoughts that coalesce together. And yet another approach sees consciousness as the method by which our higher-order brain functions direct and signal lower-level processes. But no matter the theory, in these ideas, consciousness is the result of deterministic processes. We have our consciousness, which relies on the neurology of the brain, which in turn relies on basic chemistry and physics. It is the complexity of the brain and the mysteries of consciousness that gives us a range of possibilities as we try to reconcile free will with causal determinism. So perhaps there is one more option to consider. Perhaps the universe is not deterministic. This statement flies in the face of modern scientific thinking, but as successful as modern science is, it does struggle to explain many components of the natural world. It could be that not all aspects of the world are causally deterministic, and our brains are one of these aspects. Science has forged ahead in explaining and understanding the causal, deterministic parts of the universe, because ever since Galileo, that's what the machine of science has been designed to do. But there may be more to the universe than just that. As an example of this statement, consider the beginning of the universe itself. In causal determinism, the current state of the universe flows from the past state according to the laws of physics. But what about the initial state of the universe? What about the laws of physics themselves? Even if some exotic, currently unknown process triggered the Big Bang billions of years ago, then what caused that previous process to exist in the first place? What caused or triggered the laws of physics? Even an eternal universe is difficult to explain. Why is there something rather than nothing? This is a long-standing problem, showing that as powerful as causal determinism is, it does have its limits. Or perhaps the universe is deterministic, but not always amenable to the laws of physics. Perhaps some regions of the universe, like the inside of our brains, are so complex, so intertwined, that they will always stand beyond comprehension. Indeed, the philosopher Douglas Hofstadter has hypothesized the existence of strange loops, which are mathematical structures that are deterministic but repeat back on themselves in complex, unpredictable ways. And yet another possibility is that chaos theory and quantum mechanics somehow interact in the subtle neurochemical transmission system of the brain, where they would combine to allow for a myriad random, uncertain possibilities given a set of inputs. In this view, free will is a real thing, born from the unpredictable nature of fundamental physics. Perhaps we will never discover a set of physical laws that allows us to explain how the brain works. In that case, free will is still an illusion, but one that we would never be able to decipher or untangle. Humans would always act in ways that are unpredictable, and we would always have the sense that we are in control of our own decisions. Yet that is not quite the end. There is one more way of looking at it. The debate between free will and determinism naturally presents itself as an either-or option. You must pick one or the other. But there is another way, called compatibilism. Conceived by the philosophers David Hume and Thomas Hobbes, compatibilism relies on the fact that we have not yet discovered all the laws of nature, and that new knowledge may find that deterministic physics still allows for free will. Specifically, in this framework, free will is defined as the ability to choose one option when presented with an alternative that just as easily could have been chosen, and both options are allowed by the laws of physics. Imagine that you're out to dinner and you're trying to decide between two meals, steak or the chicken. You ultimately choose the steak, and in a deterministic universe, that choice was dictated by the laws of nature. But consider an alternate reality where you chose chicken. In that universe, that choice is also dictated by the laws of nature. Either way, you haven't broken any laws or invoked any supernatural powers over causality. Both options were allowed. Incompatibilism, a deeper understanding of the laws of physics, would reveal how this works. We do not yet understand such a theory, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. If we had that more advanced knowledge, then we could rectify free will with determinism, because our new knowledge of physics would clearly show that they are compatible. So to the compatibilist, the fact that there seems to be a rift between free will and determinism is really just showing us how limited we are in our understanding of nature, physics, and the brain. And so, there is no consensus as to the true nature of free will, whether it's a real facet of our experience or just an illusion brought about by a deterministic universe. As for what you choose to believe, that's something only you can decide. Or not. You've been watching The Entire History of the Universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.